Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes tells a story about love. He says that once, near the beginning of time, there were three types of human, one male, one female, and one that was part man and part woman. Each human type had four hands and four feet and one head with two faces. And what they lacked in beauty, they made up for in power and bravery. They even dared to attack the gods. Zeus, as usual, lost his patience and resolved to split these creatures in half to diminish their strength and increase their numbers. His plan was that there'd be more people to offer sacrifices, but they'd be too weak to challenge the gods. However, with the split, he inadvertently created us, lonely creatures forever searching for our other halves. Aristophanes explained to Socrates, "Human nature was originally one, and we were a whole, and the desire and pursuit of the whole is what we call love." That's one version of love. It still seems to have strange echoes in the culture of today. But how has the Western understanding of the philosophy of love developed since Plato? And has it always been about finding our other half? With me to discuss love is the philosopher, Professor Roger Scruton, author of many books including Sexual Desire. Also with me is Angie Hobbs, lecturer in philosophy at Warwick University and author of Plato and the Hero, and Thomas Docherty, professor of English at the University of Kent. Angie Hobbs, the type of love I briefly described that Aristophanes described is only one possible answer to Plato's question. Socrates has another answer. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Socrates agrees with Aristophanes that love originates in human imperfection and lack and need. But he claims that what we lack and need is not our other half, but the beautiful and good. He claims that love generally is a desire to possess the good forever, and that, of course, implies that love also desires immortality. Now, as humans, personal immortality is not available to us. All we can do is to produce creations that will live on after us. And the means by which we achieve the production of these creations is through the inspiration of a beautiful beloved. And he goes on to outline three main types of creation which are open to humans. The first, and in Socrates' eyes the least important, is biological offspring. Next come heroic deeds and lasting fame. And finally is the production of works of science and education and legislation and art and philosophy. And the crucial point here is that though these creations can, in some instances, be motivated by love of a particular individual, Socrates thinks that the greatest creations will be produced when our erotic energies are diverted away from particular human beings and onto ever more abstract, beautiful objects, culminating in the vision of the beautiful itself, the form of beauty.
So the erotic is a sort of engine which raises a ladder out of which we can climb to higher things.
Precisely. Socrates describes this ascent away from the particular individual towards the form of beauty as precisely a ladder of love.
So love is a benevolent driving force.
It is, yes.
Or it can be.
It can be.
Yeah, we'll come back to it. We'll come back to the other side later in the program.
Yes.
Roger Scruton, would you agree with, can you comment on that, develop that?
Well, of course, that's an excellent account of what Socrates says, and it makes clear, to my view, what's wrong with it. Because if the whole culmination and fruition of love, it consists in this emancipation from the particular and the wedding and becoming wedded to the universal, then the individual object of love falls away as irrelevant. Yet that's what love is. Love is love for an individual. So Socrates has given you a theory of love and why it is a great and good thing, which makes it something not love at all, but a kind of intellectual contemplation of an abstract idea.
So what was Socrates basing his idea of love on? What sort of observations, what sort of deductions did he use to draw him to the notion of love, which led him to these ideas which, although you've challenged them, have been pervasive and still are pervasive for 2,500 years?
I think what his persuasive and, well, moving about Socrates' portrait of love is not what it ends up as in this contemplation of the abstract idea of beauty, but what it begins from. It begins from this erotic attachment to the pure incarnate individual, and the trouble that that causes to us. You know, Socrates is aware of the trouble, partly because, you know, in the Greek world to which he belonged, often this attachment was homosexual, and there were all kinds of interdictions as to how it could be fulfilled and how it shouldn't be fulfilled and so on. And he came up with the idea that, of course, to give way to this as a merely carnal thing would be to demean yourself, demean yourself as a rational being, to become enslaved to the particular, enslaved to the flesh, and our duty as free rational beings is somehow to transcend that attachment to the incarnate human being and rise up to something more spiritual. And that's why he gave this account of the ladder, I suppose.
I'll come to Thomas Socrates here. Maybe this isn't the beginning of, perhaps there are precursors of Plato here, but it's at a time when it is stated that eros is to do sex, let's use that as a shorthand for eros, although it isn't adequate, but never mind, is what we have in common with the animal kingdom, and therefore it is a lower thing. Now that seems to me to be worth commenting on and developing and perhaps challenging. What would you like to say about Thomas Dougherty?
In relation to the kind of literary manifestations of all of this, I mean, literature is precisely what deals with this contest, as it were, between the demands for attachment to particularity on the one hand and the demand for a kind of rational social commitment, which is literature's version, as it were, of the universal on the other. And the way in which we see that treated, I think, in literature is partly to do with what we might think of as, you describe it, Melvin, as a kind of an animal drive. I prefer to think of it just as the kind of physicality of love. Love as a rather material and eventually primarily sexual activity. And in the history of literature, that the primacy of that sexual commitment is not always there. Literature, primarily really from about the 18th century onwards, is trying desperately to negotiate a relation between the demands of sense and sensibility, as Austin will explicitly call it, the demands of a reasoned love, loving someone for particular reasons, and on the other hand, a love which is ostensibly not quite irrational, but not a love that cannot be accounted for in reasoned terms, so that we have a love that eventually becomes something rather immaterial. And the way in which we see that in literature is in terms of a kind of contest between, if you like, the demands of sex on the one hand and the demands of the social on the other.
But just to stick with the Greeks for a moment, it's very clear, very clear, but stick with it. This idea of sex being a lower thing is establishing a hierarchy, which is, it seems to me, very interesting. Maybe it's a real hierarchy, but why should it be the lower thing? And he doesn't, as far as my reading of it, Plato doesn't say it's sort of physical. He says it's because it's animal, because it makes us like animals, and we don't want to be like animals. We have something else. We have something of the divine about us. So let's get away from that. That is a lower thing which you must escape. I want to sort of challenge that and have your opinions on that. Do you want to comment, or Angie, which of you?
You mean to challenge the idea of
that it is lower. It is necessarily lower. Do we still accept it is necessarily lower?
I think interestingly, what has happened in the 20th century, certainly in the literary manifestations of this in the 20th century, is that sex became the only way in which we began to think of love. And now, as we go into a new century, that is again being challenged. And we're going back, if you like, to the version of Plato that you're offering, where you have a sense that there is a kind of sexual element in love, but it's not the only element in love. I mean, the great move through the 20th century is that love becomes a question of technique. It becomes techne, becomes quite simply how good you are at this other activity called sex. But we're now beginning, I think, to rethink this in terms of sex being an other activity.
I'll come across you in a second, Scruton. Can we talk about Plato's second broad definition of love, which is called philia? Can you describe that before we move on?
Yes, philia is familial love or friendship love, and Plato never comes up with a definition of it in the way that he comes up with some definitions of eros, erotic love. He does discuss it in a wonderful dialogue called The Lysis, and it's never quite clear whether good people are friendly with other good people because of their goodness or because they lack something or need something. It seems to me that in The Lysis, Plato may be exploring, if not challenging, the notion that all human love stems from lack and need, because the models of friendship that he critiques in The Lysis all fall down because they all seem to stem from the idea that friends must lack, need something in their friend. And if somebody is perfectly good, that they won't need friends, they won't need that kind of love. On my reading, Plato might be raising questions and saying, well, maybe not all forms of human love need to stem from lack, although when he discusses eros, he does seem to accept the model of love based on lack.
What value does it now have? You know, when you say, I love someone, to someone who knows you love them, that is a specific, particular, local, and one hopes, proper value. But the word's thrown around all over the place now. People go, I love you, all over the blooming place. It's like, it never used to happen in my childhood, actually. but it does, and it just seems, what's left of it?
This hasn't happened recently, Melvin. After all, even when we were young, the ordinary Cockney approach between man and woman was to call the woman darling, you know, or love. Then this promiscuous use of a holy word is an old English habit, you know. Now perhaps people use the F word, the BBC wouldn't allow me to pronounce with the same promiscuity as they used to use the L word. And it's still, you know, one shouldn't say that's because we make it any more cheap.
Can we move to what could be called the dangers of love? Andrew, would you like to kick off with that? What dangers were spotted, as it were, originally, as we can take Plato as original, and how have they developed in the philosophy and literature of love?
Yes, well, Socrates makes it quite clear in his speech in the Symposium that if you stay at the level of erotic attachment to a particular individual, you are living a very risky life. You risk your lover dying, you risk your lover withdrawing his or her love, you risk what Socrates calls the potential for enslavement in love. So he sees this particular erotic attachment to one individual as no life for a free human being. And he believes that his ladder of love offers us a very comforting picture in which we can ascend to a place where we are free from such shackling desires and demands, and where and from which we can view the individual not as a unique particular who can have a particular hold over us, but simply as an instantiation to a greater or lesser extent of the form of beauty itself. So particulars lose their unique particularity. They become seen simply as earthly copies of the divine form of beauty and the other divine forms, and they become simply tokens of a universal type and hence replaceable. And Socrates thinks this is a very liberating form of the rechanneling of desire. Now, whether we would agree with Socrates is another matter. We might well find such an image rather disturbing and chilling.
Thomas Dockett, is it about the Renaissance and afterwards that it becomes prevalent for several hundred years that individual erotic love of sentiment is dangerous and can be poisonous and can ruin lives and can lead to all sorts of... It becomes a great part of... Is it reflecting life, do you think, or is it instructing life?
I think in that early modern period, certainly what we're seeing is that the love we've been talking about is always a question of risk. When you say I love you to another individual, what you're looking for is an investment that's going to yield a return. You do not want the person, typically you do not want the person to reply to you, well, frankly, I can't stand your guts. I mean, you know, what you're looking for in reply is I love you too, but more. So it's, as it were, it's like a kind of banking investment almost. And what you're seeing, I mean, you see that explicitly in the opening scene of King Lear, if you remember, it was the great opening scene of King Lear. What I'm interested in is the predicament in which a potential lover is put. At the beginning of that play, the conventional view is that everybody's there, everybody's at the court, in order to see King Lear splitting up the kingdom. But why is he splitting up the kingdom? He's splitting up the kingdom because he's got two daughters who's married and one daughter who's about to be married. One daughter who he clearly wants to marry off to the Duke of Burgundy, who's waiting in the wings. At that moment, he puts Cordelia into an impossible position, because he says to Cordelia, "Tell me how much you love me." And Cordelia is profoundly aware of the fact that Burgundy is in the wings and she's about to be married off to him. How can she swear huge love to her father when she's about to...
How can she say, "I love you all"?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. She's put in a predicament where she's having to, as it were, limit her investments, so to speak, or to control or regulate her investments. And that's where the element of risk comes in. And what we have in the modern period, I think, is a sense of love as... something so absolute, we will pay homage to the absoluteness of it by being willing to risk everything for
it. Is it? That's, I think I was delighted you came into that, because is Cordelia's management of her divided love, the sort of sense and sensibility that she takes on both in a way, can that be contrasted with Desdemona's passion of throwing herself out, pure sentiment, a man who she's warned against and who will drive her to destruction and does destroy her? Can we see those two as the pillars of the way that the ideas of love moved into a more modern world through literature? Roger Scruton.
Difficult question. I would say that there's an enormous difference between Desdemona's case and Cordelia's.
That's the interesting thing.
Cordelia is, as Thomas was saying, I mean, in a position where the language of investment makes sense, because after all she's having to balance familial love for a father, against married love and the erotic basis which that implies, and of course that's not a calculation that anybody can seriously make, certainly not when challenged in this way, whereas Desdemona, is her love is through and through erotic, and the whole purpose of the play is to show that a love can be both erotic and wholly chaste. And yet Othello, precisely because the love is erotic, is subject to this temptation, the terrible temptation that we were obliquely referring to before, of seeing the animal part of it as predominant, and therefore at being at every moment open to the possibility of sexual jealousy.
But fulfilling the very ancient idea that erotic love inevitably leads to jealousy and revenge.
It doesn't inevitably lead to that.
It can inevitably.
It can lead to that.
We draw inevitable.
Othello makes a mistake just in the way that Lear makes a mistake by putting emphasis on the wrong aspect of love.
Can we move on to the philosopher Kant, Roger Scruton, and what did he contribute to this debate about love?
Well, Kant was typical of the whole tradition of Western philosophy in that he didn't really have much experience of this aspect of human life. No, there were a few exceptions. But
a great number of chaste philosophers, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And Kant was chaste in both senses. There were three women who wasn't to marry him. He couldn't bring himself to go ahead with it. Kant is famous for having produced an ethical theory which is, as it were, adapted to the condition of enlightenment man. It's an ethical theory which makes no mention of God, but which nevertheless captures the absolute force of morality as we all of us experience it. And in particular, he takes the view that that the categorical imperative, as he describes it, tells us to treat human beings, and ourselves among them, as ends in themselves and never as means only.
Means to our own end.
Yes. Yeah. He does think that there is contained in that idea the basis for a sexual morality. And he returns to this topic several times in lectures on ethics and elsewhere, always with a slightly bleak vision. He describes marriage, for example, as a contract for the mutual use of the sexual organs, which is a very unappealing conception of what actually induces people to tie themselves forever to each other. You would think that surely love is something more than that.
Can I turn to Thomas Douglas? Thomas, you raised earlier Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen's book. Yeah. I think the ideas expressed about Kant by Roger, they apply there, don't they? Especially the notion of marriage. Am I right?
I think so, to a large extent, that's true. And the account that Roger gives, I think, is broadly accurate. And is reflected in the literature. But again, what you're seeing there is a kind of contest between a kind of love that can be rationally described in the rather bleak terms that Roger has given us in those Kantian, the passage from Kant. You've got a love there that can be described in rational terms. What Austen's interested in is whether it is possible to articulate or enact a love that is equally reasonable but cannot be accounted for in such schematic, abstract terms.
But the resolution, it seems to me, and if anybody's going to correct me, you three are, is in marriage. That's where sense will take us only so far and can be monstrous. Well, sensibility can take us only so far and will be monstrous. Mm. In marriage, these things can be resolved. And you find that very admirable in the philosophy and the philosopher himself, Hegel, don't you, Roger?
Yes. I think Hegel is sort of unique among philosophers in that he actually was married.
20 happy years.
Yes, he did have produce an illegitimate child beforehand.
Aristotle.
Yes, Aristotle was married, but we don't know about whether he was happily married or not.
We don't know that about many people.
But, what Hegel says, and implies, is very close, actually, to the underlying meaning of, as I read, of the Jane Austen novels. The erotic does have its roots, of course, in animal instincts, and nobody can deny that, but it also is intrinsically moralised, as it were, by us. We're always making this distinction between the right and the wrong employment of it, and this creates a huge tension in us, which demands resolution. And this resolution can only occur by transition to a higher stage, to another stage of being, where your union with the other person is such as to cancel all these tensions. And finally, there is complete trust, which, as it were, unites you as a composite corporate entity, and you face destiny together. And that, I think, is a beautiful idea.
Is there a sense, Andrew Hobbes, in which Freud recategorised love at the start of the last century or the start of the last century?
Oh, yes. For Freud, all forms of love, including the affections that you feel for your family and friends, have their origins in various forms of infantile sexuality. Now, some of these infantile sexual urges are inhibited by our culture. And these aim-inhibited sexual urges, Freud argues, are later transformed by a process he never makes entirely clear into the affectionate component of all our adult loves. So all aspects of our adult loves, not just the explicitly sexual ones, but the affectionate aspects too, have their roots in these infantile sexual longings, some of which have been repressed and inhibited.
Do you think this was a recategorisation which was something that... Is this recategorisation something you welcome, Roger Scruton?
I neither welcome it nor believe in it. I think the whole thing is a load of self-serving myth in the minds of a perverted paedophile.
Freud you're talking about.
Yeah, I really
just
think
as well
this
as dead,
is... I really think it is complete nonsense. There is no empirical evidence for it. It's all established by consulting one play of Sophocles. You know, it's a wonderful piece of literary criticism that led to this notion of the Oedipus complex. He was a failed literary critic, or actually, as Leslie Chamberlain says in her book, recent book on him, he's a failed artist. But the scientific basis for this is zero. And also, I think it's led to a complete corruption in people's attitude to children. This underlies people's sense that really sexuality is always there and always ready to be exploited. And of course, there is a whole couche of human society for whom that is a green light.
Angie Hobbs, I would guess you'd disagree with that.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that Freud thought that all forms of sexual activity were to be despised. I mean, he does say that he thinks that in a mutually loving context that sexual pleasure can provide humans with our most intense satisfaction and fulfillment, and it's the nearest we can get to returning to that original state of bliss from which we were dragged away during childhood. However, it's also true that he does emphasise some of the negative dangers of erotic attachment too, particularly if your love object doesn't reciprocate. And he does also say that he does think that some forms of aim inhibition are a good thing, because given that aim inhibition of early sexuality leads to the development of the feelings of affection later on, he thinks these feelings of affection are much more durable than feelings of erotic passion, and are hence much safer bonds with which to bind society together. And this is one of his main themes in one of his last works on civilization.
Can I move from Freud to D.H. Lawrence and bring the literary parallels in again, Thomas Doherty? What did he take or add to this discourse on the philosophy of love?
I think he's broadly consistent with Freud in the sense that, despite what he himself would say about psychoanalysis, he's broadly consistent with Freud in the sense that for him, love becomes primarily a question of sex, and what I was earlier referring to as love as technique. So what becomes interesting in D.H. Lawrence is not just the regulation of passions, but the physical manifestation of those passions, the acknowledgement that love must be physical, and eventually that becomes part of a general tendency, I think, within 20th century literature, that love is kind of elided. Love becomes something which gets obscured under a question of sex and how we organise ourselves in terms of sexuality and in terms of something that we call desire. And desire, of course, is something which, after Freud, we can account for almost in quantifiable terms.
Roger Scruton.
Yeah, I think another way of putting that is to say that that in Lawrence, the sexual act is essentially nuptial. And what he's exploring is the nuptiality of our relations with each other. That's to say that even in Lawrence, marriage, not that perhaps in its institutional form, but something like Jane Austen's vision of marriage as the culmination and the end point of this is still active in animating his language and the way in which he describes the sexual act.
Sorry, Thomas Doherty, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I was going to say that in Lawrence, there's a further complication to the whole thing in that even if such a sexual union of polarities is ostensibly achieved, it's never quite enough. That Lawrence, famously at the end of Women in Love, we have an erotic relation, a heterosexual erotic relation, which is somehow not enough.
He still needs a friend. Birkin still needs
and
a friend.
It's that question of love and friendship, eros and philia, which comes back.
Gosh, we've effortlessly come full circle. We're near the end of the program. We didn't even organise it. Thank you very much, Roger Scruton, Thomas Doherty and Angie Hobson. Thank you very much for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.